This is the one with Huguenots and Catholics, and Queen Catherine de' Medici, though she hardly says a word, and King Charles IX, though he just wants to play tennis. And then there's the doctor, who might be the abbot, but since both are on holiday, who knows? It's called The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. Here we go. We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space,
counting Daleks, Thalant, Ood, and the Cybertronic race.
Some Taurans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales.
And the Doctor has a TARDIS, we're reviewing all his tales.
Who back when?
Reviewing all of who there is.
Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey. What other choice could there be than
who back when?
Who back when?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another fantabulous episode of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin. Yes, I am. And once again, I am joined by literally no one else. Why is this? Is this the first time you're tuning into this show? Probably. All right, check it out. I'm probably going to have to speed through this every single time I do one of these solo episodes. Here's the dealio. If you've listened to the past few classic reviews, then you'll know the deal. So, you know what? Feel free to zone out for the next 15 seconds or so. But the deal is basically there are a whole bunch of completely super duper mega missing lost episodes at this junction in Doctor Who or in Classic Who. And because I don't want to subject my Classic Who co-host to the arduous task of going through these lost episodes, because at times it can be quite soul-destroying. I mean, you know, Mythmakers, for example, it was pretty difficult to get through it, even though it's a great story. For that reason, I'm doing most of these lost episodes as solo missions. I will, however, just to clarify, I will be joined by some other people for possibly some of the lost episodes, but most definitely the still existing episodes leading up to, shall we say, Pertwee, when everything is still at hand. And in fact, the next episode, the next classic review that we're doing, it's going to be a we're doing it as opposed to I'm doing it. I'm going to be joined by someone else. So that's pretty rad. If this is the first time that you're tuning in, feel free to listen to this whole thing. Or if you prefer listening to the banter exchange between two or more people, you know what? Check out some of our other reviews. Either way, no judgment. Okie dokie. Let's go on. Today we are reviewing. Holy shit, I've already gone completely schizophrenic. Okay, today I am reviewing C022, The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, or simply The Massacre, as it is also known in the novelization, for example. It's another historical, and it is at once fantastic and a little bit pants. Let's see if we can get to the bottom of why that is. I think it's B-Scout time. The Doctor and Stephen materialize in Paris in 1572 and almost immediately split up. Doc wants to meet an apothecary slash scientist named Preslat and heads off in one direction, while Stephen is left in a tavern where he befriends a bunch of Huguenots. Then he, literally and figuratively, bumps into a servant girl named Anne, who has overheard a conversation between some Catholics in which they refer to the terrible massacre of Huguenots in Oissy, saying that it's going to happen again before the week is over. So now Steve decides to join forces with his new buddies to try to alter history to save them all, and, one final note here, just to make things really weird, it seems as though the Abbot of Amboise, one of the main guys behind the next purported massacre, looks exactly like the Doctor. Is he the Doctor in disguise? You'll have to watch the serial, or listen to this podcast, to find out. End of B-Scow, you are welcome! I hope that helps. Okie dokie, here's the deal. This is a 4-episode arc. All 4 episodes are completely lost. So what I've done, what I'm reviewing here, is essentially the recon. Why am I saying essentially? It is the recon. That's what I looked at. It's the Loose Cannon Productions reconstruction of The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. And once again, gotta say, up top, Loose Cannon Productions, you've done a fantastic job, especially since it really does appear as though very, very little remained of this serial. So well done, guys. Thank you very much. And I'm now sitting here with a glass of water to my right and a glass of Pinot Grigio to my left. And I suggest you do the same. Let's jump into this bad boy. Episode 1. The War of God. Doc and Steve materialize in France, scare the bejesus out of a young boy who looks like he may later have grown up to become Ricky Lake or someone. And Doc reckons they're in France, where gates are never opened and solely used for hiding TARDISes. Judging by the clothing of two chaps, Nicholas and, cue the most frequent French name in fiction, Gaston, though I suppose he could have been called Pierre or François maybe. Anyway, judging by their clothes, that I've already said anyway, the doctor deduces that it's the mid-16th century when a group of highly advanced apothecaries were active in Paris. Coincidence alert, guess where they are? That's right, Toulouse. I'm kidding, they're in Paris. We also get some historical context that won't make sense until a little while from now, in that Nick and Pierre don't believe in discretion and thus loudly announce that the Catholics are assholes and that they're annoyed by their activities. Cut to an inn, where Nick and Gaston Pierre toast to the Protestant Henry of Navarre, and some other French dudes counters with a toast to his bride, the Catholic Princess Marguerite. Nicholas starts spouting some rather well-written witticisms about the Catholics, and the other guy, Simon, takes offence. Simon, by the way, wears your run-of-the-mill giant collar, so let's just call him Frilly Collar, just to keep it clear. So, Frilly Collar bribes the landlord to spy on Nick and Gaston Pierre François, now officially identified as Huguenots, and tells him to report back anything Protestant and unsavory, shall we say. Frilly Collar leaves, and in step Doc Hammer and Steve Meister, now sporting period clothing, and now we get that one image that I'm guessing all of you who have Googled the serial will have seen, i.e. the image of them sitting down in a corner booth sipping wine. Though Lord knows where they got the wine from. They haven't ordered anything yet, so they must just be drinking people's leftover backwash. That is gross, guys. Absolutely gross. Anyway, they split up now, obviously. Doc wants to go hang out with the main apothecary dude, Preslin, and Stevesy wants to go sightseeing, but on his way out, Doc is seemingly recognized by someone just entering the tavern. So we already get a taste of this going to be a story of mistaken identities. And apparently, Doc is then followed, presumably by the chap he nearly just bumped into as he left, and Steve Meister notices this. I say presumably because as far as I can recall, there's no mention of it in the recon, but there is on TARDIS Wikia, and Steve Aruni does bring it up shortly. Spoiler alert for 15 seconds from now. Yeah, let's press on. Steve wants to leave, then makes a friend in Nick, who pays for his backwash, and bids him to stay. Steve tells him all about the doc being followed and whatnot. Shit, I just totally spoiled that for you 15 seconds ago, apologies. And even says the whole thing about the doc being a scientist and wanting to chat with the head apothecary gringo. Bad idea, Gene, says Nick, and they start drinking. Transpires, you see, scientists aren't very popular among the Catholics. Bing bong, Doc meets Charles Preslin, who feigns being someone else, then comes clean, and then the two of them lunge into a germanological wankathon. Steve Z, Nick, and Pierre Baguette, meanwhile, are swinging backwash, and Stevie Rooney reluctantly mentions he was just in Egypt, then prepares to shoot off when we get an action cutscene. A young woman, or girl, crap, I can't even remember if she looked legal, whatever. She's being chased by the Cardinal's guards and escapes into the tavern, bumping into Steve as she does so. The guards head in after, but the captain of the guard is stopped by Baguette, who delivers some witticisms, unsheathes his sword, and pretty much implies that should the guards insist to see the girl, he will slice off their ass cheeks and pop them on a tartiflette. The guards abscond. And we learn that the girl was a servant of the Cardinal's who escaped, presumably because working conditions were rather poor, and or the Cardinal wanted her to bake more than one type of croissant, if you know what I'm saying. I don't know what came over me there. Yada yada yada. The girl is nowhere to be seen now, but wonder if she'll turn up again later. Back at Preslin's herbal shop of medicinal wonder, we learn that the abbot of, I can't quite remember, Amboise, that's it, the abbot of Amboise, the right-hand man of the cardinal in Rome, is now in Paris and intent on hunting down all these heretic scientists, and Doc starts hatching a plan to influence the abbot otherwise. And in doing so, let's just make this clear, alter history. And let's put a pin in this that we will continuously refer back to. Blammo, let's go back to the tavern, where the young girl, Anne, now turns up and explains that the reason she ran off in a fright was because she overheard the captain and some other soldier gringos talk of another Huguenot slaughter in Vassy, where her father died in the last one 10 years prior. Blam! Cut to the bad guy's lair, by which I mean a really nice salon, presumably one of several in a humble, centrally located chateau with a little garden and a large library. I'm only assuming, of course, but these guys are pretty refined. There's bound to be a library somewhere, and an actual bondage cupboard. Bondage cupboard. There's something I gotta do. Okay, where was I? Alright, shit, I am actually losing my marbles. Yes, the bad guys, led by Captain Frilly Collar, agree that Anne needs to be silenced, so Frilly orders his men to seek out any relatives she may have in Paris, because she might be hiding there. Bada bing, we're now back with Anne, Steve-Z, Baguette and Nick. And the French guys give Anne directions to a hiding place while the landlord indiscreetly eavesdrops. Then Nick, I think Nick, might have been Camembert, I can't remember, gives Steve-O some historical context, i.e. Protestant prince, Catholic princess, yada yada yada, the Catholics now plot to kill the prince and a bunch of non-regal Protestants as well, blah blah blah, and then Nick or Flaubert leave Steve-Z to his own devices. I hope this is not too much all over the place. Whatever. Cutscene alert. Back in Preslan's shop of medicinal marvel, Preslan's paying the boy we saw at the start of the episode, the one who looks like a young Ricky Lake, for showing the doctor the way. Where to? We don't know yet. Only time will tell. Possibly, probably not. Spoiler alert, no it won't. We will have no idea where he's off to. Anyway, meanwhile, Steve-Z is still waiting in the tavern by himself, wistfully looking out the window, hoping for the swift return of his sugar daddy, the Doc Hammer, when suddenly Simon, aka Captain Frillycollar, enters and squeezes the landlord for information about Anne's current whereabouts. Blammo. Then he turns his attention to Stevie Boy, tells him the curfew will be in effect shortly, and that if Steven doesn't get his tourist ass somewhere indoors, Simon's gonna have it for breakfast. God damn it. Then Nick reappears. Please bear in mind, he's been away maybe at a stretch 2 minutes. Steven, you're still here, he shouts. Well, no shit, Nick. You didn't give him any time to leave. Anyway, Steve's gonna crash in Nick's man cave. Then Simon, that's Frillycollar, de-vords himself and orders the landlord to keep him abreast of any developments, particularly if the old man returns. And then we speed off to the final scene of this episode that cements its place in the annals of weirdom. Simon arrives at the abbot's shag pad, and we see that the abbot looks just like the doctor. In fact, is even played by William Hartnell in his Doc Hammer wig and everything. So at this point in my notes, I've written the following. I'm just going to read it out. Spoiler alert, this isn't going to be one of those William Hartnell's Getting a Tan and an HJ in the Maldives serial. This is going to be William Hartnell goes Peter Sellers and plays multiple characters. Let's see if I got that right. I'm not going to spoil anything. Kablamo, end of episode 1, episode 2, The Sea Beggar. Steve-Z checks out the tavern the following morning, but there's been no sign of the doc, who, I think we can all agree at this point, decided sometime the night before that he was infinitely more interested in messing with history than he was in even giving half a toss about the Stevemeister. Meanwhile, in Nick's shag pad, Nick and Cordon Bleu vent their frustrations about Henry of Navarre's refusal to take the Catholic threat to his life seriously. Henry of Navarre, for those of you who don't know history very well, or who didn't Wikipedia this like I did, I think I'm busted, that's the Protestant prince. Anyway, in plops a disillusioned Stevie Boy, who asks for, and is immediately promised, Nick's help to find the docks, as in boats and whatnot, where he reckons the dock is, just to make things really, really confusing. And then in plops another fellow, namely Roger Colbert, pardon my pronunciation, Roger Colbert, or the Colbert Report, what am I going to call this guy, Rog, the newly appointed secretary to the abbot, and he asks for Anne Chaplet, the servant girl, but Nick just blatantly lies and says she's not there. The girl even enters the room, recognizes Rog, and fucking bolts back out in the fright. And Nick still lies for her. Rog leaves dismayed, and Steve fingers him, figuratively, as the dude who followed Doc as he exited the tavern the other day. Then they look out the window where the abbot himself is waiting. I mean, either he suspects that Anne heard something dreadfully incriminating, or he really wants a slice of that pie, n'est-ce pas? Anyway, because Steve recognizes him as William Hartnell, shit's getting real at the Chez Nick et Galois, and heads up, this is pretty dumb. In fact, one of the few truly dumb moments in this serial. What happens is that, moronically, Nick and Baguette assume that Steve-Z is working as a spy for the abbot. What? If he were a spy, surely he wouldn't enlist the services of the people he'd been spying on to take him to the guy who supposedly and clandestinely employed him to spy on them in the first place. The theory makes no sense. Pourquoi? Parce qu'it's dumb as shit. We get a little cutscene of Captain Frillycollar chatting with the Marshal. I can't quite recall who he is, to be honest. Anyway, one of the other main conspirators behind this massacre. Anyway, let's ignore the confusing fact that both the Marshal and the next chap about to enter his office are wearing frilly collars, too. Seriously, you'd think they were in fashion or something. Whatever. Let's ignore that and just say two things. Firstly, I thought at first that I recognized the actor portraying the Marshal, but I think the reason for that is simply that he looks like a transporter accident of everyone who's ever been on any show ever, including Doctor Who. Check it out. There's a screenshot on the site, so see for yourselves. Try, for instance, to find a bit of any Doctor in his face, and there's just as much Colin Baker as there is Capaldi in him. I'm not lying. It's really freaky. Column 2. The Marshal doesn't trust the Abbot for some reason, and I'm pretty sure he tells Captain Frillypants to keep tabs on him. Yada yada yada. Some other dude pops by, no one gives a poop, let's cut instead. To Steve Z, practically decking some Catholic lady when he and Nick at long last discover the door to Preslan's shop. The old crow claims he's not been there for 2 years or so, though. Not since he was arrested for being a heretic. So that's pretty trippy. If she's telling the truth, then whom did the doctor meet with? So I'm assuming she isn't telling the truth. She's either lying or she just doesn't know anything. Anyway, Steve Z reckons Doc is impersonating the Abbot. Remember, he saw the Abbot being played by William Hartnell from Nick's window. But Nick now assumes that this is proof of Steve Z being a spy. So Steve Meister now bolts. Across town, meanwhile, Captain Frillyface and Rog are discussing the Dutch. And someone codenamed the Sea Beggar, who is to be assassinated. And Frilly McGillicuddy knows just the man to do the job. This assassination, that is. We also learn that Rog only just met the Abbot for the first time the day before. So he could be the Doctor in disguise, I'm thinking at this point anyway. I mean, obviously, there's really no one in Paris, it seems, who can corroborate the Abbot's identity. So very possibly he is actually the Doctor in disguise. Let's find out. Let's carry on. Anyway, yeah, put that in a noun and verb it. Okay, we head back to Nick's where he's chatting with Anne about Steve. She reckons he's a good guy and not at all a Catholic spy. Then, blammo, Citoyen turns up and explains that I'm just going to go with whatever standard stereotypical French words I can think of instead of saying Gaston, because, you know what, frankly, I'm here by myself and I have to entertain myself in some way, right? Anyway, so Citoyen turns up, explains that the Protestant prince has agreed to heightened security after all. So I guess they introduced that subplot to us earlier just to screw with us. The subplot of him declining any kind of security. So that didn't pan out at all. Anyway, Nick and Pomme de Terre agree they know where spying Steve is now. Namely, with the Abbot of Amboise. Cut to the Abbot's place, which Steve Z is furtively approaching, Vord hiding from guards and whatnot, even Spider-Man-ing up the freaking facade of the Abbot's house and Vording outside his freaking window. Actually, before he approaches the window, he nearly bumps into a dude in monk's robes, and he looks like maybe he recognizes him, and I thought I did too. I thought it was Hartnell. That's, in my notes, I've written monk equals Hartnell question mark. But there is no indication of it in the recon, and there is no reference to it. Spoiler alert, there's no reference to this later on, except for the fact that Steve Z actually recognized him, or thought that maybe he recognized him. So this is, like, it's like they're dropping all these little hints, and they're never going to pan out. I mean, we've encountered this before on the show. Obviously, this isn't completely new, but still, it does annoy the crap out of me. Anyway, I really have to stop saying anyway. Turn that into a drinking game. Inside the apartment, meanwhile, the Abbot's apartment, that is, are Captain Frillyface, Rog, and the Marshal. Remember? The guy who looks like everyone. Mashed together. As in, he looks like everyone mashed together. Captain Frillyface, Rog, and Marshal are not mashed together. You get what I'm saying. Anyway, they are saying, A, that the Abbot is nowhere to be seen, and B, that the Sea Beggar will be attending a meeting at the Louvre the following day, and that their badass assassin... They're bad ass in. Sorry, cracking myself up. Anyway, let's call him Danny Trejo to keep it simple, if I can remember to do that. He's going to fucking slice him a new aorta in his ass with some fava beans. Concluding words of the scene, the hit was ordered by the Queen Mother. Steve overhears all this and then scrambles off. And let's just take a tiny little moment to ponder what's happened here. He has just bumped into someone in monk's robes that he thinks he recognizes, and that, yeah, I didn't rewatch this episode, so I only have that first impression to go by, but I thought this was Hartnell. And we've also been led to believe that Hartnell is impersonating the Abbot. I mean, we know that Hartnell is playing the Abbot. That is to say, we've been led to believe that the Doctor is impersonating the Abbot. And we've heard that the Abbot, whom no one can corroborate is actually the Abbot, has suddenly just disappeared and no one knows where he is, which, by the way, spoiler alert, is not going to pan out. So he's just disappeared just as we've seen someone in robes scamper off. So everything at this point, everything, and I think you can deduce, if you haven't seen the show already, I think you can deduce what I'm getting at here, but everything is really pointing at the abbot really being the doctor, right? And he's just put on another disguise, he's affected whatever amongst disguise and then popped off again, whatever. All right, let's not even bother putting a pin in this, it's not going to pan out, whatever. Cut to Nick's pad, where Steve now enters as though they parted on good terms, starts rummaging through the desk like an idiot, is caught by Raclette, attacked by Galois, this is the same guy, guys, refuses to sword fight with Latrine, and is eventually thrown out by Cravat without having had a chance to tell Moulin Rouge the news. Is that all clear? Did you just tune in? I'm talking about Gaston. Okay, moving on. Steve leaves, and Nick immediately enters. Do they pass each other on this pretty small set? Nope. And Nick is effing all ablaze when he finds out what a schlemiel Tartuffe was for kicking him out into the street. Oh, and we learn that he, Jacques Tati, I mean, is going to be at the Louvre with the beggar, I mean the prince. This is what we're guessing anyway. We're assuming the prince is the beggar, right? Because we've been told that the prince is going to be assassinated, presumably by the Catholics. So, whatever. Fuck, I think I maybe just kind of spoiled that for you. But you, whatever. All right. We assume this is the prince. He's going to be there with the prince at the Louvre the following day. Cut to the street, where Steve Z is being followed by Anne. He realizes this, and surreptitiously leads her down what can only be described as rape central. One or both of them are likely to be violated here. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at that. Anyway, it doesn't really seem safe at all. She follows, though. He apprehends her, and she explains that she wants to go with him. So now there's still no doctor, but at least Steve has a new companion. I guess, anyway. They set off towards the port. And we get a closing scene with some admiral I can't remember seeing before telling Nick that he convinced the king to go to war against Spain. This is historically interesting, but will not pan out within the confines of this show. Spoiler alert. Blam! Episode 3, Priest of Death. My opening note here, and I quote, "What the fuck is Hartnell even interested anymore?" Because yeah, if you hadn't gathered already, this did turn out to be one of those William Hartnell storing lines off a stripper's back on the Costa del Sol kind of serials. Steve and Anne spent the night in Preslan's shop, and no, don't. Good God, lady and or gentleman, get your head out of the gutter. So they slept in the shop. Separately, one presumes. Preslan's nowhere to be seen, by the way, and Steve now intends to go stop the murder somehow, even though he's not quite sure who it is exactly that is meant to be murdered, assuming that he'll bump into the doc disguised as the abbot, who'll pull some strings to see him safely through the rescue attempt. But in order to do so, he'll need a disguise, as Anne explains, because otherwise Captain Frillyface will recognize him. So Steve steals a cloak and a hat and says now no one will be able to recognize him. But I mean, what now? He's wearing the hat on top of his head, not over his. And he's slung a cloak over his shoulders. He's not changed clothes altogether. He's not wearing any other kind of disguise, like a fake nose or a beard or an over-the-clothes merkin or something. Come to think of it, much like Ian before him, he must be sponsored by Gillette and appears utterly incapable of growing even a 5 o'clock shadow. So, whatever. We then get two fantastic cutscenes of the Marshal and his bonhommes meeting with Queen Catherine de' Medici and King Charles IX to discuss the potential of war with Spain. Why do I say these cutscenes are fantastic? Glad you ask. There's more than one reason. Care to guess how many reasons there are? That's right, there are two. Number one, they're super well written, and suddenly, for the first time in the serial, in fact, they feel really adult and, like, serious. The humor lies in clever witticisms, and the substance of this interlocution lies in the actual down-to-earth real politics of war. Basically, they're talking about how to finance it. Number two, the king and queen are amazingly poorly written. The queen, in fact, has no lines whatsoever in these scenes, and she just sits around like a fat sack of easily discardable potatoes, while the king is just there as a segue out of either scene, because we cut as soon as he goes, "Listen, chaps, all this talk of war is boring and complicated to me, so let's switch topics, eh, what? And come on, Admiral, let's play tennis, respectively." That's ridiculous. That is absolutely... That is just silly. Okay, very poor writing, but great scenes, though. In between and after them, we see Steve and Anne heading to the abbot slash doctor. And that they do. Bada bing. Hartnell's back from Ibiza, and while some adjutant is around, Steve offers him Anne. The abbot is pleased, even though the marshal appears and explains that the girl is of no importance. That's a direct quote. Well, okay then, but it certainly seems like this is not the doc now. This is just a lookalike, albeit a very convincing one. So Steve and Anne step outside for a mo while the abbot chats with the marshal about the impending assassination, revealing that the mark, codename Sea Beggar, is in fact not the prince, but the Admiral. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Steve overhears this, and he and Anne exit stage left to Nick's love shack and tell him all about it, whereupon Nick just immediately bolts to the Admiral's rescue. Blam. Literally. We get a super long scene of the assassin lurking in a window with a musket or whatever as the Admiral walks down the street. Then, whammy, Nick arrives too late. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because, like, literally nothing is panning out here. It is fantastic. The super professional hitman, by the way. This freaking Jean Reno as Leon. This Edward Fox as the Jackal are rolled into one of this story. He shoots the Admiral. In the arm. Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. In the arm. Come again, please. I think the fridge is humming or something. I still can't quite hear my past self saying that. Okay, just to make this clear, he shoots him in the fucking arm. Really? What the shit? This is what all the fuss was about. I know I've been speeding through this serial, but this is, like, almost three full episodes into the thing. Like, this is... Okay, but, sorry, that's not three full episodes. This is, like, 2.5 episodes into a 4-episode serial. We have been hearing about this assassination by some professional assassin since almost the very first instant. We've heard about people trying to rescue the guy being assassined. The guy is too late to thwart this assassination attempt. But on top of that, the assassination attempt is a failure. So, like, I'm sorry, I cannot stop smiling at this. This is ridiculous to me. Nothing is panning out. The assassination isn't working out. The rescue attempt isn't working out. All of Steve's efforts have been for nothing because it didn't matter in the end anyway, because the Admiral was going to survive, so it doesn't really matter. And by the way, spoiler alert, it doesn't even matter that he survives, because later on we find out in kind of a little slapdash comment that he's going to die anyway. So, it is fantastic. Anyway, so he's been shot in the arm, and I'm not very impressed by that. Though I suppose back in the day you could quite easily die from a wound like that. I mean, flipping Barry Lyndon lost his leg in a duel after all, right? Moving on. We now get a scene in which the abbot and the marshal are informed by Rog that the assassination attempt failed. And the marshal says something here that's... what the heck? We haven't had a soundbite in a while. 343, what do you say? Soundbite?
Soundbite!
Soundbite.
It is strange, Father Abbot, that since you came, everything which had been so carefully planned has gone wrong.
That totally makes you think, perhaps it is the Doctor pretending to be the Abbot. He did tell Preslan that he'd fix the situation somehow, right? Maybe this is him screwing with history, which wouldn't be the first time. Anyway, Rog summons guards and the Marshal orders them to kill the Abbot now. This is crazy. Well, I guess that's one way of doing the Pepsi challenge, unless Catholics regenerate too. Cut to the king being told about the assassination attempt by, I can't recall whom now, and the queen, as usual, just keeps stum. Actually, she tells the messenger to come in, and that's it. She even leaves the room halfway through the message. Women, right? I'm kidding. It does seem like the writer, hang on, give me a sec, John Lucarotti, his name. It does seem like he had particular difficulty with this character, right? I mean, because she's going to appear one more time, I think, and at that point she does speak, but up until this stage in the serial, whenever she turns up, she says nothing. She just sits there in period clothing and that's it. So it seems really superfluous. I don't even really understand why she's in the scene to begin with. It doesn't matter. So the king is furious and calls for the council to be assembled. The council, who are they? We don't know. Do we find out? Sort of. Can't really remember. Doesn't matter. And he says the assassins need to be located and punished. Back at Nick's pad, the Admiral is losing a lot of blood and Stephen still professes the abbot to be the Doc in disguise. This I do not understand. I mean, he even overheard the abbot talking about the assassination. How deep does he think that the Doc's cover is going? I think it is pretty reasonable to assume at this point that you all get what I got at this point as well, that the abbot is not the Doctor unless this is the most poorly written undercover story ever, right? Whatever. Bada bing. Then they learn of the assassination of the abbot. So now it should be clear, right? The abbot is dead. He was killed outside his own home. And guess what? That's right, they're blaming the Huguenots. So now they're all boned, and while Stephen may not be completely familiar with the happy end nature of Doctor Who, the TV show that is, At least we can now assume that it wasn't the Doc, but just some coincidental lookalike, right? Think so. Okay, so the King gives the Marshal orders to empty the streets of Catholics and ensure the Admiral's safety. Then he's left alone again, and the Queen enters and proves that she can in fact speak, let alone act. Well, in fact. And here's something I didn't quite catch. Pretty sure she tells him that the Marshal was behind the assassination attempt, and that he, that is to say, the King, should be pleased because the Huguenots all just want to kill him and replace him with Henry of Navarre, the Protestant prince. I think that's what happens. I'm not entirely sure. If anyone knows any differently, just let me know. Put a comment on the website. All right. Outside the abbot's house, meanwhile, Hartnell's lifeless body remains on the ground, and a bunch of people has congregated around it to shout mean things about Huguenots. Steve Z pops up and inspects the body, is still totally convinced that it's the Doctor's, and is then, as we wrap up this penultimate episode, chased down the streets by the bloodthirsty mob. End of episode 3. Episode 4, the final episode of this serial, Bell of Doom. It really does feel like I'm speeding through this. I don't know if I am. I know I speak very quickly. Sue me. Anyway, ding dong, Steve Z and Anne rendezvous in Preslan's shop. Still no sign of Preslan, by the way, who very possibly has actually been gone for 2 years, in which case I still don't know whom Doc met with. I don't really get what happened there, and the... whatever. And the Stevemeister explains that Doc is dead, and that he needs to find the TARDIS key to get back home. Which is kind of weird to me as well, because does he know how to maneuver the TARDIS? I don't think so. He never got the same how to operate a time machine for dummies that the Doctor gave Barbara and Ian, right? Back in the chase. Oh, unless actually he was lurking around on the planet Mechanus and overheard, like eavesdropped on the for dummies lesson as Doc was giving it to Babs and Ian. This is not entirely unlikely. Anyway. Since he knows faux shizzle that Doc Hammer visited Preslan's shop at some point, the two of them start scouring the place for his original clothes and belongings. And then we get a quick cutscene of Captain Frillyface and Tavan, the dude who looks like everyone else, only older. And the latter is called to see the Queen. Just a quick cutscene. And then we're back with Steve Zianan, and she's found the Doc's cane. And then all of a sudden, kablammo, who appears if not the Doctor? Phew, there's a load off. For a moment there, we all thought maybe he was done for. Cutscene alert, then we get a quick scene of Nick Boulangerie, the wounded admiral, and some other dude chatting, can't remember who the other dude was, and we learn that the King has placed some Catholic guards on the admiral to protect him from, well, Catholics. And Biciclet is not amused and gets the shit out of there. Blammo, back with Steve Z, Anne, and Doc. Or SAD, for short. Doc now learns that it's the eve of St. Bartholomew's Day in the year 1572, at which point he immediately shoos Anne away, telling her she'll be totally safe, but to stay indoors the following day just to be sure. Steve Z protests, and Anne clearly wants to stay with Steve, but the Doc has made up his mind, so off she goes. And Doc and Steve follow suit as they need to leave Paris fucking pronto as well, right? Blam. Let's head over to Marshal Tavan, the older lookalike of everyone, who has a hit list of Protestants to slaughter the following day. And then in steps Queenie. Sorry, I said before that she was going to appear once more. She's going to appear twice more, so this is now the second time. The fat monster that she is turns up and declares that she's going to rally the mob to kill all heretics instead. So there's no need for the Marshal's puny list. What a freaking nutbag she is. Tavan's clearly now, quote-unquote, one of the good guys, sort of. I mean, relatively speaking. Because, I mean, while he's okay with killing some Huguenots, he doesn't want the innocent to die, basically. The only thing he manages to do, though, is to convince Fatty McQueenface to spare Henry of Navarre, even though the reason for this is simply to avoid an international incident. Queenie accepts, as I said, and then leaves, ordering him to close the gates of Paris so that no Protestants can get out. In steps Simon, aka Captain Frillycollar, who's a right prick. When he hears of the Queen's order to let the plebs kill everyone, he starts squelching hate juice out of his throbbing erection, but the Marshal then orders him to escort Henry of Navarre to safety, which will also mean that Frillycollar won't be able to partake in the slaughter himself, as in personally. Much to his dismay, Frillycollar, flaccid yet bloodthirsty, leaves the Marshal's office. And we can only assume, by the way, we can only assume, we are not told as far as I recall, that he's going to go through with this. Blammo! Time to head off now, and we see Doc and Steve-O dodge some guards and pop back into the TARDIS. And then we hear them dematerialize, so they have now left. And then, at least in the recon, we're treated to a 1 minute montage of various wood and copper engravings depicting the massacre that ensued. Seriously vicious stuff. Back in the TARDIS, Steve is now lamenting the fact that they didn't save anyone, and we get a Doctor soundbite here. Soundbite? Soundbite.
In any case, I cannot change the course of history, you know that.
Which goes hand in hand with what he said back in, for instance, the Aztecs, but not with any of the myriad other occasions when they've attempted, or in fact even succeeded in changing history, such as causing the fires of Rome, or inspiring the construction of the Trojan Horse, and thus the penning of the freaking Iliad, killing people left and right, and so on and so forth. Plus, in this episode alone, Doc told Peslam that he might be able to help him, i.e., by changing freaking history. And Steve clearly interfered with events in his dealings with Nick and Foie Gras, right? No matter. They're back in the TARDIS now, let's press on. We get a little history lesson here as the Doc explains 10,000 people died in Paris alone, and confirms that the Admiral, Nick, and Cordon Bleu were killed as well. Steve is particularly upset about them having left Anne there, though. She didn't have to die, he says. And there's an odd, illogical twist here. Because Doc says perhaps she did survive and he was right to leave her there. So, wait, I don't get it. Does that not presuppose that he is able to alter the course of history? As in, he could have taken her with them in the TARDIS, but since she may have been of historical significance, it's a good thing that he didn't pluck her out of her own timeline? That's certainly what it sounded like to me, so perhaps all these statements a la, I can't change history, are actually intended to mean, I really ought not to. Pretty interesting observation, though I say so myself, n'est-ce pas? Well, I'm saying that because it's in my notes for this point of the episode, when I saw it that first time. But in a mo, spoiler alert, it'll actually be confirmed, so let's put a pin in that. Pin time! Anyway, Steve is appalled and vows to leave the TARDIS wherever and whenever they arrive next. That's a shame, I think. Cut to some actual video footage as they materialise. Steve, gets on the scanner, and the TARDIS doors open. Back to still images again, and Steve reaffirms that his mind is made up, and he steps outside into what in my notes, and I shit you not, this is freaking worth a pin, I've got down as, quote, what looks like it might be South or West London circa 1966, end quote. Alright, and the Doc now has a tiny soliloquy about the massive expanse of time compared to the blink of an individual. And we get another soundbite, and this is where the pin comes in, the one before. As the Doctor says, soundbite?
I dare not change the course of history.
Q.E.D. But this is a really sad moment, I really have to say this. The Doc's now all alone, and he sits down and he talks to himself about how everyone has left him now. Steven, Vicky, even little Susie. And then there's a bit that, if it was intentional, it's just pure genius. But if not, it's pretty funny. Either way, definitely worth another soundbite. There's gonna, yeah, sorry, there are a bunch of soundbites here in one go. Here we go, soundbite, soundbite.
This for Barbara and Chatterton. Chesterton.
How appropriate is it that he gets Ian's name wrong? That's just fantastic. And I'd like to think that it was scripted. And then, whoa mama, do we get a revelation. Doc says,
perhaps I should go home. Back to my own planet. But I can't.
Holy frack, the hairs on my arms stood at end when I heard that. Absolutely a first on Doctor Who. So far, we've not heard any of the Doctor's Gallifreyan backstory. This episode is worth watching for that statement alone. Cut to outside, where a familiar-looking girl is running, according to the recon, across Wimbledon Common. Remember I said the sliver of the outside that we saw when Steve disembarked looked like South or maybe West London? Wimbledon is in freaking South-West London. Man, I'm good. Alright, so that's one pin taken care of. So this girl, she runs up to the TARDIS and enters it, thinking that it's a police box. And then she asks the Doctor where the phone is, because there's been an accident or something, and she needs to ring the police. And even when he tells her repeatedly that she should find another police box, she insists on asking, freaking over and over again, where the phone is. Also repeating, but this is a police box, isn't it? What the shit? She's just run into a small wooden box, only to find it infinitely bigger on the inside, full of futuristic gadgets, emanating an odd fucking hum, and manned by an eccentric older gentleman. How the balls can she still assume it's just a police box? This girl is already getting on my nerves, and her accent, which, although I can't place it, normally when I hear it sounds really charming, in her case it just makes her seem even less intelligent. Okay, another weird thing here, or a first on the show rather, when she assumes that the Doc is a policeman, even though why the fuck would he be one? I mean, hang on, I'll get to that other thing in a sec, I'm still annoyed by this goddamn idiot. Doc's not wearing a uniform, he isn't acting like a policeman, freaking police boxes were not police stations, they were just phone boxes. Even if it weren't for all the gadgets and the dimensional discrepancies and the hum and the fucking obvious fact that this is not a regular police box, it would be more likely, I think, to assume that a homeless crazy person had taken up residence inside the box than that a lazy, slapdash, geriatric, clearly beyond retirement age policeman without a uniform should be manning it and not reacting to an emergency. Fuck this girl. Okay, so, what I was going to say before, the other weird firsts, whatever. The doctor introduces himself as a doctor of science and as a time traveler. But scratch that second bit. We already knew that. He said that. But the first bit, a doctor of science, that has not been mentioned before. Only in the non-canonical Cushing movies does the doctor have an actual doctoral title, or in any event, self-identify as a doctor as opposed to the doctor. Pretty cool, no? Don't think so? Just me? That's okay. Agree to disagree. Right. So Stephen gets back on board the TARDIS now too and tells the doc that two police officers are heading towards them, and Doc immediately dematerializes the TARDIS, and weirdly, Stephen is the only one who has a rational reaction to all this. He sees the girl, oh shit, I hate her, and goes, do you not realize you may never get back home again? We're traveling through time and space. And he is appalled by the doctor's thoughtless abduction of yet another young girl. Seriously, have you considered that, by the way? The doctor travels around space-time, abducts young girls, and dematerializes before the police arrives. He exhibits almost all the characteristics of a predator. Okay, whatever. The doctor thinks he did the right thing, though, because they didn't want the police to storm the TARDIS after all. No, of course not, Doc. They might find all the other oiled-up remains of girls you've picked up over the years, right? And, okay, moving on. He adds, the new girl looks just like his granddaughter, Susan. Very weird. Even though, I suppose it's not entirely untrue, although Susie was cuter, by the way. But this is kind of a weird observation. Like, oh no, it's fine. We've kidnapped this girl now. We don't know what her story is, what her, like, historical context is. We have no idea. For all we know, she is just as likely to be important to history as Anne Chaplet was back in Paris, right? We have no idea. But because she looks kind of like his granddaughter, the whole thing is okay. That's really weird. Anyway, we also learn now that the new girl, in terms of being told about the TARDIS, will go from incredulous to indifferent in about 5 seconds. And also that she's an orphan who lives with her aunt, who apparently wouldn't give half a shit if she never saw her again. So problem solved and abduction justified. She introduces herself as Dorothea Chaplet, Dodo to her friends, and Stevesy and Dockhammer both assume that she's the great-great-great, etc., granddaughter of Anne Chaplet. Meaning, Anne did survive the massacre of St. Bart's back in Paris. And that's it. Dodo insists on not being called Dorothea, Doc is thoroughly amused, and Steve Meister apparently has unleft the TARDIS. So that's another thing that never panned out. End of serial. You know what? I'm going to break for another glass of wine and a lucky strike, and then I'll be back with a mini-review.
Review!
I'm back. Okay, where to start? First off, what a fantastic historical. There is action and suspense, a plethora of believable, relatable characters, for all I know, historically accurate. And I know I did the whole most frequent French words in place of Saint Gaston thing, but there were far fewer stereotypes in this one compared to, say, Reign of Terror. Production value appears to have been marvellous, with gorgeous period costumes, interior shots of offices and apartments and so on and so forth. That is the superficial bit. Plot-wise, I both love and not quite hate, but not quite love either, this one. I mean, this thing is so elaborate, what with the abbot and the queen and the prince and the 54 other characters working and conspiring against each other and so on and so forth, but that almost makes this a better historical than a Doctor Who serial. I mean, where was the flipping Doctor? I thought at first that he'd gone on holiday, then that he'd played a different character, and then he went on holiday after all. Most of the weirdo, complicated subplots of this serial never come to fruition. Doc left to meet with Preslin, then through poor writing we find out that Preslin was arrested ages ago, never explained, and that doesn't pan out. Doc tells him that he'll see if he can help, doesn't pan out. He leaves to do something, clearly, but in the end we're never even told where he's been all this time. All of the plotting to assassinate the Admiral, nada, he survives, okay, and then we're told he perished with the rest of them later on anyway, okay, doesn't pan out. We meet the Queen as an antagonist and the King as a buffoon, but there's never any twist in sympathy or a catharsis or something for either. Doesn't pan out. Steve wants to leave, says he'll leave, leaves, then he's suddenly back. Not even that pans out. And then there's the ending with Dodo. Really? Are we actually going to do this again? I'll reserve judgment until I've got to know her a little better, but in the meantime, I'll still disapprove. Thank you very much. While I think the TARDIS desperately needed a woman's touch, that doesn't mean the Doc should abduct one who, for all intents and purposes, appears touched. We'll see if I change my mind about her. I doubt it. All in all, I'm sorry, this is the shortest mini review ever. This is the most mini of minis. So, as I was going to say, all in all, as a complicated historical that could easily have been swapped out for, like, let's say, The Scarlet Pimpernel, I like it. I really do. But as a Doctor Who serial, I don't dislike it per se. I just don't really get it. Thus, I'm giving this 3.6. Really sorry, it's a great serial, but I have to duck marks for it not quite being Doctor Who. 3.6.
Listener minis.
And we've got two fantastic mini reviews. Thank you so much for sending these in. The first one comes from Gallifreyan Buccaneer. Hello again, Alan, how are you doing? Everything good? I hope so. Alright, here we go. Alan says, wrapping up what I like to call the First Doctor's Death and Loss trilogy is the massacre. That's right. Holy shit, Alan, I'm sorry. I said I was going to bear this in mind and point this out. I never did. I will do so after reading your mini. Here we go. He goes on. Or The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, if you want to be pedantic. Another favourite of mine that has to be watched in sequence with both The Mythmakers and The Daleks' Master Plan to truly be appreciated. At the end of the Dalek Master Plan, we have both the Doctor and Stephen haunted by the loss of Katerina, Brett and Sarah. The TARDIS team has returned to two, not seen since we first met the Doctor and Susan. That sense of loss weighs over this story, but is also exacerbated by the events that take place. After the first episode, Stephen is left alone in a pub in a foreign land and time, and won't meet the Doctor again until episode 4. Or will he? Enter the Abbot of Amboise with a striking similarity to the Doctor. We as fans can speculate that this is the time stream being weird again. Salamander will be the spitting image of the Second Doctor in Enemy of the World. Commander Maxil, played by Colin Baker, shoots the Fifth Doctor in Ark of Infinity. And Cecilus in The Fires of Pompeii has the distinctive eyes of a future incarnation of a particular Time Lord. Very true. Also, gotta say, the Second Doctor and Colin Baker reference, totally news to me. I had no idea. This is very interesting. Okay, he goes on. The problem with this serial being a recon is that we are unsure if the Doctor is impersonating the Abbot, as Stephen assumes, or that he's a completely different individual. A good topic of discussion, but irrelevant to the story in the end. The Doctor returns in episode 4, telling Stephen that they have to leave. Stephen can't decide whether to take his new friend and possible future companion Anne Chapelet with them, and in the end decides to abandon her to an ultimately grisly fate. Once again, we have the loss of potential of a future companion, and here, even more so than the Dalek Master Plan, the Doctor has failed to save anyone. He states once more that you can't change history, something I touched on in The Mythmakers, where he himself does so, admittedly out of desperation, but it leaves a bitterness against the Doctor, that he can change history to save his own skin, but Stephen can't save the innocent Anne. So when Stephen is so disgusted with the Doctor's actions and threatens to leave this death-filled adventuring, it's hard to argue with him. That's very true, but I'm not entirely sure I agree with you 100%, Gallifreyan Buccaneer. Let's put a pin in that. Okay, he goes on. It's all the more poignant as we as viewers feel frustrated that after the events of the Dalek Master Plan, Stephen decided to hold his trust in the Doctor throughout the massacre. Friendship and trust is broken and it's heartbreaking. The contemplation of the Doctor alone for the first time in his TARDIS is one of my favourite scenes in all of Who. Hartnell's acting is superb, as far as we can tell from the audio, and hammers home how alone he can feel away from his home and his race. So out of all this death and loss comes hope in the form of Dodo Chaplet, her surname implying that Anne did survive the massacre, coupled with her youthful energy and lack of puzzlement, bring fresh air into the stagnant TARDIS. Stephen returns to the TARDIS, the Doctor has a granddaughter figure to dote upon again, and the team set off to a brighter future. The massacre gets a 4.5 out of me. Holy Jesus balls, Gallifreyan Buccaneer. 4.5? Really? Really? Okay, all right. I see what you're saying. This is, once again, thank you, by the way. Thank you so much for sending it in. Once again, you've sent in a fantastic review, and it is very insightful. But there are a few points here that I think, to all those who have, you know, been listening to me ramble on for, what is it now, like an hour, just under an hour, you probably know exactly what I disagree with. A, I don't think that the Doctor truly says that he can't alter history. I think he really says that he shouldn't. I mean, he does make it very, very clear that maybe Anne could have been of historical importance, and therefore, had he rescued her, he would have been changing history. And that I understand. Like, okay, fine, he did the right thing in not changing history, but in doing the right thing in not changing history, that implies that you are able to do the wrong thing and in fact change history. And later on in this very self-same serial, he does change history in taking Dodo with him, right? Also, I don't know if you've maybe listened to an audiobook version of this, or if there's, I mean, there is a novelization of this, and I cannot claim to know either. I have not listened to an audiobook. I have not read the novel. In fact, I'm going to guess that JD has. JD, speak up. If you've read it, let us know. Put a comment on the website. But is there actually any doubt as to whether the Doctor is the Abbot, or if the Abbot is just someone who looks the same? This is supremely interesting and complete news to me. I realize that I'm a total Who rookie in saying this, but it is news to me that Troughton and Baker, Colin Baker that is, turn up later on in other characters, in other roles, and actually interact with the Doctor of the time in that other role. I'm guessing you're right. I think that's exactly what happens here, but I don't think there's any ambiguity. I think it's very clearly not the Doctor. I mean, he dies, for God's sake. And I think this is now down to bad writing, because we never find out what the Doctor's been doing. Thank you so much. Thought-provoking review. 4.5, holy Jesus balls. Which is a weird thing to say in an episode, in a serial that concerns Catholics and Huguenots. But sorry, anyone who's religious out there and who thinks that I'm blaspheming left, right and centre. But wow, dude, seriously, 4.5, you have a huge freaking heart. And I said I was going to point this out. I'm sorry I didn't point this out during the actual, like, maxi review. But yes, the theme of loss, it is certainly... I mean, I haven't seen the next serial, so I don't know what that's going to be like. But I'm going to take your word for it. This is certainly... It's not just a continuation, it's a culmination, if nothing else. Okay, as I said, I haven't seen the next serial, so I don't know. Maybe it culminates later on. But it's, at the very least, it's an enhancement of that theme of loss. You're very right. In Mythmakers, he loses Vicky. In Dalek Master Plan, he loses Brett and Sarah and Katerina. And Stephen has already lost... He hasn't lost Stephen, but he certainly has lost Stephen's heart in a way. And in this one, he properly loses Stephen's heart and fails, as you said, to rescue anyone else. And for an instant, he actually does lose Stephen, even though, I mean, he unloses him, he regains Stephen later on. But yeah, you're right. I mean, holy crap, everything is just coming to this massive loss climax. It's just profoundly sad. And in that final soliloquy of his in episode 4, he is... I mean, in saying that perhaps he should return to Gallifrey, but then again, he can't. There's no way for him to return. And okay, we don't know yet why. It's going to take a while until we find out, I gather. But just in saying that, that means that in a way, he's almost regretting his adventures just because they've cost too much. He's lost too many friends. He's lost too many companions and, as you said, potential companions. This is a very good observation. Thank you very much for making it and for bringing it to my attention. I don't think, actually, I think if you hadn't mentioned it, I wouldn't have picked up on that, this trio of episodes or serials with this common theme. So thank you very much. Very good point. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any thoughts on this, pop it on the website and let Gallifreyan Buccaneer know. How can you do that? Glad you ask. If you happen to not be Gallifreyan Buccaneer, what the hell are you doing? Are you following him on Twitter? You should be. If you're not, I don't even know what you're trying to do with your lives. I mean, come on. Let's get real. Follow this man on Twitter. He is at Alan Trussler. That's Trussler with two S's. Thanks very much. Dude, you're awesome. Next up, we've got Steven. Steve Meister. How you doing, buddy? Steven says... In The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, Stephen is caught up in the middle of brewing conflict between Catholics and Protestants in 16th century France. This serial is Stephen Taylor's story, being the first serial to have only a single companion and the Doctor being absent for the very beginning and very end. Very true. Very good point. I like that. This is Stephen's story. You're totally right. This is Stephen and Friends. Okay, next up. He goes on. Among the thoughts that came to mind as I listened to this serial's audiobook, interesting, are that this story probably shows us the biggest difference between Stephen as a companion compared to his predecessors, especially Barbara. Stephen was completely out of his depth as he bravely but ineffectively tried to help the men who had shown him friendship. Barbara would likely have had enough knowledge to know what was coming from the outset, as the Doctor did once he realized the date, and recognized terms like sea beggar. And while Stephen did the best he could, he was ultimately lost without the Doctor's guidance. Compare this to Ian, who had consistently acquitted himself well on his own. Nicely observed, I like it. Okay. Steve goes on. Stephen's strength... Oh, very confusing here. We've got a Stephen, we've got another Stephen. This is interesting. All right, here we go. Stephen's strength is perhaps in his morality. He genuinely wanted to help people he had befriended because it was right to do so. Learning they were doomed and that the Doctor could not or would not do anything about that for even just one potentially doomed person stretched his morals to the breaking point. Yet that same desire to help his friends urges him to return to the TARDIS to warn the Doctor about police coming to use the police box despite that breaking point. While the Doctor had little role in the story, the same cannot be said of William Hartnell, as he portrayed the Abbot of Amboise. I enjoyed the tension caused by Stephen not knowing whether the Abbot was actually the Doctor in disguise, a reasonable assumption given the Doctor's track record in pulling similar tricks, but in this case, false. Interesting, here we got a guy who's totally on the same page as I am. Okay, he goes on. Something we the audience get early on when one of the Catholics reveals he'd seen the Abbot before the story, though not much comes of it, as Stephen only gets one very brief face-to-face with the Abbot. That's totally true. Holy shit, I totally forgot to mention this. Thank you for bringing this up. Yes, can't remember who it was now. Roger? I think maybe it was Roger. He said that he had only met with him the day before, but he had actually seen him once before. But that could be... Okay, reasonable doubts. We don't know how good his memory, how detailed a memory he has of seeing the Abbot before. Maybe he saw him from, like, super far away and he doesn't really recognize him. And maybe, like, it's another white-haired dude, so it could be this guy. And he just assumes. But I'm glad you pointed that out. I had totally forgotten about it. And I'm sorry I didn't bring that up, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, Stephen goes on. Another thought that occurred to me is that what is perhaps the biggest weakness of the historicals is also their greatest strength. By weakness, I mean that someone who is unfamiliar with the period being visited, such as myself, I am by no means knowledgeable about French history, that makes two of us, dude, might find it hard to follow the history side of the plot. Compare that to a pure sci-fi story where the locale visited is new to everyone. But that is also its strength, since the episodes were designed to educate the audience about these periods. Very true. I don't know French history, but I do know more now than I did going in. The one potential downside to this is that it is a particularly dark story. Perhaps not an issue when standing on its own merits, but after the so very costly victory achieved in the Daleks' master plan, a story focusing on religious conflict may not have been the greatest of choices to make. On its own, however, the story stands decently strong and earns a 3.9 from me. The only true negative was that not much was made of the Abbot's looking like the Doctor, in my opinion. The idea had potential and did create interesting tension, but in the end felt like it was only there to confuse Stephen. One final point I wanted to mention in this review is not directly related to the episode itself, but more of a general detail. Something I've come to enjoy in watching the Hartnell episodes is, once in a blue moon, I'll see something that ends up fitting modern Doctor Who every bit as well as it does with classic, despite the fact it could not possibly have been planned that way. My favourite such example is early in The Space Museum, where Barbara describes the Doctor with a line that fits everyone from Hartnell to Smith, and very probably Capaldi. The Doctor's curious, that means we stay. In this story, I refer to the Doctor's ending monologue, which fits very well with modern Doctor Who's interpretation of the Doctor as a very old, but also very lonely being. He laments his past companions being unable to comprehend the nature of what they do, and amusingly still getting Ian's name wrong in the process. Yep, that's true. Despite the usual outward grumpiness, he seems thrilled that Stephen returns and that Dodo has gotten herself hijacked, but has no issue with going back home anytime soon. I don't know if the modern-day showrunners drew anything from this scene or not. Regardless, I'm sure there are modern Who fans who will have seen their doctors in that part of the episode. Very true. Good observation. And seriously, that is incredibly true. The loneliness, the fact that he is, I mean, especially during the phase of modern Doctor being the last of his race, there is no hope of ever finding Gallifrey of, you know, just the assumption that there's no one else left and very possibly he is to blame. That echoes everything that he says in his soliloquy at the end of episode 4. Very good point. Stephen, thank you very much. Awesome review. Your points, very much more along the lines of my points. So, you know, I can't fault you for that. Thanks for sending it in. Ladies and gentlemen who are not Stephen, are you on Twitter? Great. Are you following him? Awesome. Wait, I think I heard someone out there say they weren't following Stephen? That's insane, man and or woman. That's crazy. You need to follow Stephen. He is at sgamer82. That's 82, the number. And that's it. I think that concludes the Who Back When take on C022, The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land. If you've enjoyed this, please let the world know. You can do so in many different ways. How about this to start with? Pop on over to facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word, and give us a like. Add a comment. Tell your friends to like us there as well and to check us out. If you're subscribed to us on iTunes, that's great. If you're not, please do subscribe to us on iTunes. And while you do that, why not leave a rating and review? In fact, I'm going to say this right now. The next time we record an episode, anyone who's left a review, I'm going to sing a song for you. I'm going to get whomever I'm doing that episode with. I'm going to get them to sing along with me. So please do head to iTunes, leave us a rating and review. It would be massively appreciated. Thank you. If you're not on iTunes, don't worry. You can still listen to the show. Check it out on whobackwhen.com, where you can stream everything. And while you're there, why not check out the visual index, which is constantly being populated with more and more aliens, creatures, spirits, companions, allies, historical figures, pop culture celebrities, as and when we encounter them in Doctor Who on Who Back When. So check that out. Where else can you find us? Anywhere you like. We are on Reddit, we're on Google+. Check it out. Who Back When, most often in just one word. And finally, if you've enjoyed listening to me for an hour, or an hour and a bit, I'm not entirely sure, I haven't checked the timer, then why not follow me on Twitter? That's right. Yeah. Hit me up with a hello and a high five on Twitter and I will hello and high five you right back. You have been a delight, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for sticking around. The next classic review is going to be The Ark, which, as I said at the start of this episode, I will not be doing as a solo cast. There are going to be two of us. Yeah. So look forward to that. The next New Who review that we're launching is going to be The Empty Child. Spoiler alert, it's a good one. How do I know that? We've already recorded it. It's pretty great. Yeah. Check that out. And in terms of audiobooks, honestly, I don't know which episode's going to be next because I don't know in which order I'm dropping these, but you should absolutely check that out. Ladies and gentlemen, I will catch you in the next one. Be rad and excellent to each other. Ciao.
Who Back When.